Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm Taylor Heckert. Shipping costs for parts and raw materials can be expensive in rural Alaska. In the island town of Petersburg, residents are giving items at the dump a second life through the borough's salvaging program. Isaiah Bowen Carlin reports for KFSK from the local landfill.
A handful of pickup trucks are parked near the base of a large hill of jagged metal. There's a squashed car, an old bed, and a graveyard of refrigerators.
I'm looking for parts for my truck, and then I got my mother-in-law a boat, and she wants a different seat, so I'm going to go check out that boat over there.
Ola Nordgren is one of a half dozen people equipped with wire cutters, sledgehammers, and chainsaws. They're at the Petersburg Borough's local dump, taking part in its salvaging program, which happens Sundays and Mondays. It's a $10 flat fee, and users have to sign a waiver and weigh out as they leave.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff people throw away.
That's Joseph Quitzland, a local artist and metal worker. He's been attending weekly for over 15 years and estimates he collects about 10 tons a year from what he personally calls dump church.
It's always kind of a fun mystery as to what treasures one might find, intended or otherwise. I do generally have kind of an idea of things that I'm looking for projects.
Putson points out a pile of pallets, logs, and plywood heaped near the entrance. In the past, he's found redwood and mahogany for his projects. He says he no longer needs to cut firewood out of the forest. Andrew Edfelt is nearby, dressed head to toe in bright orange rain gear.
Got a bunch of logs laid out for salvagers, and it's, you know, $10 all you can eat. Today, this is a super good deal. I don't have to drive out the road. I don't have to, you know, drag logs out of the woods.
Some salvagers also high grade, a process of separating valuable metals, like copper, aluminum, and brass, which can be sold and sent off the island. Quitson spots an old industrial motor. It's full of copper, but requires some dismantling with a sledgehammer and an angle grinder.
Much easier to dig it out here than digging it out of the ground.
Local nonprofits have also benefited from recycling the material for years. But as some programs became less active after the pandemic, some piles at the landfill have gotten bigger. Aaron Morrell with the Public Works Department said at a borough assembly meeting last summer, the aluminum pile had grown, quote, exponentially.
There's often items discarded into it which cannot be recycled, and it's unmanageable at this point, and so our staff would be thrilled to have it gone.
The assembly agreed to let a nonprofit bike park group collect aluminum and sell the scraps as a fundraiser. The borough manages the town's waste by having its garbage removed from the island. It costs about $500,000 each year. But what can't be barged out, like cars and large equipment, stays at the local landfill. Some salvagers see that as an opportunity. Israel Carlson says the program is a community resource.
It's like shipping costs is half the cost of everything now up here. So, no, I think having a yard where you can go get parts and things for stuff you need without having to drop a ton of money is pretty vital in this community. So.
Armed with a little creativity and a willingness to put in some elbow grease, the salvagers recount their best finds.
I came and got a engine and transmission for my other vehicle.
I found a gold ring with teeny tiny little diamonds in it. I gave it to my wife.
I got a mini four-wheeler a couple weeks ago, and then I threw a chainsaw motor in that for the kid. She loves it.
Well, we had an Easter hunt here, and I found a little brass statuary of leaping dolphins, which is just kind of a fun whimsical thing.
As the saying goes, one man's trash is another's treasure. Each year, the borough sells about 500 salvage permits and estimates that it removes about 67 tons from the landfill. Ketchikan has a similar program, and Wrangell used to have one before it covered its landfill. In Petersburg, I'm Isaiah Bowen Carlin.
Ketchikan School District now has more time to pay back over $5 million it owes to the borough. That's after agreeing on a new version of a repayment plan last week that includes 1 year of paying interest only. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, it's just one way the borough is working with the school district to help alleviate its financial woes.
The $5.4 million debt was discovered last year after a school district financial audit. The district and the borough agreed in March to a 3-year repayment plan of $1.9 million each year with 3% interest. That first payment to the borough was set for July. But the updated agreement now gives the school district an extra year, until 2029, to repay its debt to the borough. At a recent school board meeting, school board president Catherine Tatsuda said reconfiguring the agreement was a group effort.
I just want to say a huge thank you to borough staff and then also the borough assembly for doing this for us and working with us and recognizing the difficult work that we have done and the very serious work that we have done to bring us into a more stable financial position.
According to the school district, modifying the debt repayment structure would allow it more leeway in planning for the next fiscal year. This year's payment to the borough is solely interest, about $160,000. After that, the district will pay nearly $2 million annually through the end of the repayment period. It's not the first time the school district has suggested the idea of allowing it more time to repay its borough debt. It originally asked for a 5-year repayment to allow more planning time for school closures and staff cuts, but the borough assembly voted for a faster return. Assemblymember Rodney Dial voted in favor of the new repayment agreement at a recent special borough assembly meeting, although he's concerned about the accuracy of next year's school district budget. He said that healthcare costs are increasing and student counts in the district are likely decreasing.
So to think that next year now they're going to be able to pay this, or that they will not ask for a different modification, or that they won't add more to the debt, or they won't have a big deficit. Those are all risks that we're taking with a smaller and smaller pot of money to fill these needs. And it really goes to the central premise of what so many of us have really been trying to do, is get them to a balanced budget.
The borough assembly also agreed to set aside an additional $5 million to the borough through the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. To do that, the borough is moving nearly $3 million from its housing development fund. According to a letter from Interim Superintendent Sherry Bollert, the additional funds are needed to meet final payroll obligations, settle outstanding vendor contracts, and ensure a balanced budget at the close of the fiscal year. Three people provided public comment on the funding increase before the assembly approved it. Paul Hook said he does not agree with extending the repayment plan or giving the school district more money, and believes the district lacks financial oversight.
Money doesn't mean anything to these people anymore. It's lost its value because we just find another pile to shovel it into or out of. So I really implore you to stop your glad hands passing out money to people who don't appreciate it.
Hook also expressed concern about area-wide property taxes for schools, which help fund the school district. But Catlin Jacobson, a librarian at the local high school, K-High, said she supported extending the school district's repayment plan. She said the school district's staff has needed help from the borough for, quote, a long, long time.
It is not an adequate education. By agreeing to this payment, we're keeping us barely alive.
This is the third time the assembly has adjusted this year's school district budget, once last year and again in March. The assembly earlier this month also greenlit dedicating a portion of the borough's taxes imposed on lodging to fund the school district. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Several proposed mines in British Columbia are located along transboundary rivers that wind through southeast Alaska. Residents on the Alaska side of the border say there's a lack of tribal consultation, and some worry about pollution and salmon-bearing streams vital to the region's fisheries. KTOO's Alex Solomon spoke with Max Graham, a journalist who covers mining in Alaska for Northern Journal, about the booming industry.
Which proposed transboundary mines seem likely to open in the next several years?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of projects across the border in British Columbia of all stages. Probably the most likely to open next or soonest is a big gold and silver project called Eskay Creek, which is in the Unuk River watershed. And the owners of that project, they just got their permits kind of squared away and have an agreement with the First Nation on whose traditional lands the project is located, and that could open up within the next few years. There are a couple other big proposed projects, two in the Stikine River watershed. That's a river that flows kind of in the Petersburg-Wrangell area. Those are called Galore Creek and Shaft Creek. They're not quite as far along. And then there are kind of a handful of earlier stage, smaller projects that are even farther out and quite a bit more speculative at this point. So there's the new Polaris project on the Taku, like upstream from Juneau. There are a bunch of prospects sort of in the Hyder-Stewart area, sort of further south.
What's driving the mining boom?
With gold prices just being what they are, they've seen this like historic rise over the last few years. And that's really attracted a lot of investment and excitement in the industry. Copper and silver prices are also very high right now. But a lot of the interest in this region is still in gold. You know, at the same time, there's discussion both in Canada and the U.S. about critical minerals and sort of securing the nation's supply of metals used in energy and national security, like weapons. And so that's sort of feeding into the enthusiasm.
Last year, you covered the Eskay Creek project, a gold and silver mine revival proposed above the Unic River that flows near Ketchikan. How have sovereign tribes on either side of the border responded?
That's on traditional lands of the Tahltan Nation in British Columbia. And that First Nation has an agreement with the province of British Columbia that sort of gives the First Nation a lot of control in the decision-making process, whereas on the Alaska side of the border, that's just not the case. I think there's quite a bit of uniformity on the Alaska side about just asking for like the basic, you know, you need to consult us on these projects. Whereas on the BC side, there's, I think, more robust debate over like do the benefits that we're going to get outweigh the risks.
It seems like there's an unclear path to resolve issues around transboundary pollution. For instance, the Tulsiqua Chief Mine has been leaching acid mine drainage into the Taku River watershed upstream of the Alaska border. What are pathways for issues like that to be resolved?
There's a debate, I think a very active debate on this side of the border about like to what degree there even is pollution or to what degree we should be worried about pollution. You heard the commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game pretty much say like we haven't really detected any pollution on the Alaska side of the border from any active or historic mines in Canada. But at the same time, you have conservation groups and, you know, fishing groups and tribal leaders sort of very actively concerned that it could happen. And also huge attention has been given to the Tulsiqua Chief. If you go there or look at photos, like there is clear acid mine runoff, just like unfettered going right into the Tulsiqua River. Probably is worth establishing like what exactly are the risks. There's huge push from Alaskans to be sort of much better incorporated into decision making and into the process of like shaping how mines upstream get developed. I think there's this more fundamental question of like, how do we mine responsibly and what does that look like?
That was KTOO's Alex Solomon talking with Northern Journal reporter Max Graham about transboundary mining projects in the Coast Range. For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.